A father accused of killing six children in a house fire in Derby was apparently secretly recorded saying, "I didn't mean to do it on my life." Nottingham Crown Court heard Mick Philpott was being taped while he was in a prison van. He denies manslaughter along with his wife Mairead and their friend Paul Mosley. Also today, the distressing 999 emergency call from Mairead Philpott's been released.
We've got the police on the way. Have you any idea what's caused the fire?
I've never been able to come up by the
It's smoke everywhere.
Taco Bell's the latest company to find horse meat in its products. Its ground beef, along with spicy mince beef skewers made by the catering firm Brakes, and Birdseye traditional spaghetti bolognese and beef lasagna have all tested positive. The Prime Minister is describing the Eastleigh by-election result as disappointing after his party was beaten into third place behind the Liberal Democrats and UKIP. The Lib Dems retained the seat despite the troubles at Westminster and the resignation of MP Chris Huhne. But these UKIP voters insist they were not protesting and they would vote the same way in a general election.
Yep, I agree with their policies and everything, so yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, I don't know, I just believe what they say more, really.
Four men are facing jail terms after they admitted discussing carrying out a terror attack in the UK using homemade bombs and firearms. Woolwich Crown Court heard the men were arrested following a series of raids last April at their homes in Luton. The value of sterling has fallen sharply against the dollar. It dropped below $1.50 at one point for the first time in more than 2.5 years. Evidence suggests that Britain's manufacturing activities contracted and that more quantitative easing would be needed from the Bank of England. That's the latest. I'm Kevin Gover.
PCFM. Not too long ago, in towns and cities close to you,
the video rental shops roamed far and wide. 'Twas a glorious time for the film fans who loved them so very much.
Then one day, things changed forever.
Hello? Hello, can you hear me? This is 20th Century Flick, the last survivor of the video shop apocalypse. I'm seeking anyone out there who wants quality films at reasonable prices with no subscription fees. Anyone?
Little did 20th Century Flicks know there was someone out there for them. In fact, there were all sorts of people.
Action fans! Comedy fans!
Crime fans! Horror fans!
If you're a film fan, you'll be a fan of 20th Century Flicks.
A real, old-school video shop with no hassle involved.
20th Century Flicks. Find us at 3 Richmond Terrace, Clifton, Bristol, or at 20thcenturyflicks.co.uk. For your happily ever after.
It's Friday, 5 o'clock, and BCFM's politics show, Friday Drive Time. I'm Tony Gosling. Helping us review this week's news is Labour Councillor for Southmead, Jenny Smith. Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers is here too. After the 6 o'clock news, the BBC and documentary producer Mike Rudin specifically in court this week, accused of aiding and abetting terrorism with their deliberately misleading coverage of the 9/11 attacks. Possible sentence under the Terrorism Act 2000, life in prison. Didn't hear about that one on the BBC, I bet. Anyway, also, John Kerry, the new US Secretary of State to replace Hillary Clinton, gets the red carpet treatment at the Foreign Office on Monday. Does he think we don't know he's in the same hideous skull and bones club of which George Bush Jr. is a member? Plus, why the close links between the US and Nazi Germany at the end of World War II? Was it as simple as two words, atom bomb? Plus, Martin Summers takes his weekly tour of the world's hotspots. That's all in the second hour after six. On to our news review in a minute, but first, Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Tonight's below freezing again, down to -2, but dry. This weekend, highs up to a maximum of 9 degrees Celsius and a sunny weekend. Next week, highs of 11 Celsius, some sunshine, but plenty of showers through next week. Next weekend, that's the 9th and 10th of March, highs a little bit higher at 10. 10 Celsius, sunny spells, but some showers next weekend. That was Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. So, helping us review this week's news is Labour Councillor for South Mead, Jenny Smith. First of all, Jenny, hi, welcome to Drive Time.
Right, thank you.
And what about you? What are your thoughts about the results last night in the Eastleigh by-election, triggered by the criminal conviction of the former Energy Secretary Chris Hoon, the Liberal Democrat?
Well, the Labour Party was fighting in an area which is the, normally the Tory hinterland, and it was a fight between three of the other parties. We held our vote.
So are you saying that Labour wasn't really hardly involved in that? I mean, you're saying the three parties...
No, we were involved,
but it was... talking about UKIP, the Tories and Lib Dems.
Yes, but it isn't normally. It's our 123rd on the list to try to win, which means we had accepted a long time back that it was one of those that was not normally going to be Labour. It's normally Tory.
But normally
the Liberal Democrats took it from them.
But normally the main opposition party would expect to be gaining seats in by-elections like this, wouldn't it?
Well, we would hope so, but the industry down there has changed. Most of the railway work, which used to produce a heavy labour boat, has gone, and what you're talking about is luxury yachts, very high-powered homes. It's not the normal place that the Labour Party would pick up boats from. In other words, it's less middle classes and less working class area.
Well, I suppose because Chris Hoon was a cabinet minister, he was in a safe seat. They normally tend to do this, don't they? If someone is in an important position in the government, then they're somehow moved into a place where they've got a safe seat, and it's very unlikely they're going to be voted out. Of course, one of the exceptions to that was the BBC's chairman now, Chris Patton, when he was in the early 90s. He was removed by the public in Bath when he was a Bath MP.
Yeah, I stood against Chris Patton in Bath.
Did you?
Yes.
When was that? And
4 years
that.
Before he actually lost his seat.
That was an exception to the rule, really.
And
most
I held
the
Labour vote, which was my job. I was told to do it to stop the Liberal Democrats getting the constituency.
Okay. How have elections changed, do you think, over the last sort of... That was probably 20 years ago, wasn't it?
It was 1980...
Crikey, even earlier. How have elections changed over the last 30 years then, Jenny?
Oh, they're not the same. I mean, now it's... I think they get very vicious. They also warp the truth, whereas some of us old-fashioned ones try very hard to stay at the truth, to stay with the facts.
But I mean, surely the voters will respect you for that, as of someone who's being honest, and vote for you, won't they?
I think that gets lost in the publicity from the press, most of which is owned by Tory supporters. It gets lost on the media that really doesn't always represent both sides. And what we really want are people to think about what the Labour Party are doing and listen. And I was quoting an incident just now where the Bristol Evening Post, I put it in writing where we stood on housing and an housing issue, and they warped it. Well, that's not helping the public understand the difference between the political parties.
How do you mean they walked it? Warped it, yeah?
Yes.
It changed what you'd said.
They did.
In what way? Come on, tell us what you said, tell us what they said.
Right. What I was saying was we weren't going to oppose what the mayor was proposing. However, we did have a different idea that we felt would work perhaps better, that could work alongside him. And it was to do with housing and where to get the money from so that we can kickstart this city into building housing for people on low wages and people who are desperate now in bed and breakfasts and various hostels around the city. In other words, we had a different proposal, but we weren't opposing the one he was putting forward.
Okay, and how was that represented by the Post?
The Evening Post tried to make it sound like we were absolutely against what the mayor was proposing. We were just thinking of different ideas.
Well, it's easy enough to blame the media, but I mean, certainly the owners of the Evening Post have got their own political position as well, which they don't necessarily broadcast, they don't shout about. But I mean, with this bedroom tax, for example, a lot of the media are talking about it as a bedroom tax. Actually, it's not a tax at all, is it?
No, it's taking away benefits from people, and I'm getting the most worrying cases I'm finding out that anybody who's on oxygen or has dialysis, all sorts of things at home in a bedroom, if their partner wants to sleep in the other room, then they fall foul of the bedroom tax. When soldiers come back from the various places they are in our forces, then their mother, who has kept a bedroom ready for them because it was their home and where they grew up and where they will be secure after going through really nasty situations in the forces, mothers aren't able to keep the bedroom for their sons or daughters because they're taking away benefits.
Well,
and I can move on with all sorts of instances. And anybody who decides, well, oh, okay, I will have to get somewhere with less bedrooms, then if the council, and the council are clearly saying they haven't got enough properties to go around, if they can't provide one instantly, they still lose that benefit. And it's about withdrawing benefits from people. And it seems so unfair, the way that the whole system is working.
Well, it may seem unfair, but I mean, surely what's built up over the years with the nanny state is a something for nothing culture. And I mean, when there's less money to go around, the government have got to save it from somewhere.
Yes, but these are people that are vulnerable. These are anybody under 61 falls into these criteria. And what I can say is that it hasn't been thought through, that the impact on communities, because many of these are people that fit into communities, maybe if they're ill, they've having support from families or friends, they could easily be moved a long way away from all that support and could ultimately cost the state a lot more money in the end.
Before we completely get off the subject of the, you call it the Evening Post. I'm trying to get myself to call it the Post because they've got rid of the this sort of facade of it being an evening paper because it comes out.
I don't know because I don't buy it.
You haven't seen a copy of it, right? But what are your thoughts about the ownership of it and the editorial line? I mean, obviously you're not happy about the way they've spun something that you've said as a councillor. But what about more generally? Why don't you read it? It's an important thing to read the local paper, even if you don't agree with it, to see what they're saying, surely.
But less and less people are buying it. The only people that are buying it mostly are to find jobs, if there are any going. And it doesn't actually talk about the heart of the city. And a balanced newspaper would represent everything that goes on in the city.
I mean, they had, for example, the letters page, which has a very lively debate goes on in there between, for example, the Liberal Democrats and UKIP this week have had a bit of a barney. Trevor Coleman, one of the MEPs, and I think it's Graham Watson, the MEP who's a Liberal Democrat, also having a big discussion. I mean, those sort of things do happen.
Well, I accept that. But then we find that some of us Labour people write to the Evening Post and they don't get published.
Well, you can't
and then you think somebody is actually weeding out certain political parties so that the other parties do get the publicity and do get their points over.
Well, I must admit, I do quite usually turn first to the letters page as the most interesting section of the paper, rather than the quite sensationalist headlines sometimes on the front page.
Our press officer puts out press releases, which we often don't get published by the Evening Post, so we feel that there is an imbalance in representation of what some other people in this city believe, think, and what ideas they have. And some of the ideas that we have as a party may well be worth listening to.
Before we talk to old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers, I'm going to have a look at my updated version of the City Slackers, which is going up online this weekend. The City Slackers are, democracy is all very well when it works, but after electing councillors and MPs, are they there for you when you need them? We have local elections here in May, so good time to update my list of City Slackers. If you've not come across the Slackers before, it's a little list I've been compiling over the last 2 years of politicians that return neither my phone calls nor my emails. requesting that they come onto this programme. They've simply refused point blank to come on. If politicians have unavoidable commitments every Friday between 5 and 6, I offer to move the time to a pre-recorded slot or do the news review on the phone. So this really is a list of those MPs and councillors who've either stonewalled, that is to say they say they're prepared to do the show and then won't reply anymore, or simply won't communicate at all. Now, I realise MPs and councillors are busy people, so each has been contacted at least 4 or 5 times by phone or email, usually twice or three times by each method. So politicians may well think there's no point in coming on this show. After all, we're only a little community radio. They may think going door to door and talking to you face to face is the best way to get you to vote for them. But the evidence is to the contrary. Many people say not one single politician knocks on their door. Only leaflets come through, or they just hope to get in a safe seat on the party ticket. No, the problem with this is if a politician doesn't return calls and emails, even taking a few seconds to explain why, how likely are they to deal with the questions that after you elect them? Now, I'm giving those on this list every chance to come off the list in the run-up to this May's local election. So, first, the MPs, representing all 600,000 of us, the Bristol conurbation, has 6 MPs, 1 Lib Dem, 2 Labour and 3 Conservative. Bristol East is held by Labour MP and Treasury opposition spokesperson Kerry McCarthy. She has been on this programme many times and is quite happy to. Bristol South is a safe-seated deputy speaker of the House of Commons who's retiring at the next general election. Just had a hip operation, I think that's Dawn Primorolo. Bristol North West MP is Conservative Party's Charlotte Leslie. Bristol West is Lib Dem former tax avoidance consultant Stephen Williams, and Kingswood's MP is Conservative Chris Skidmore. Finally, Filton and Bradley Stoke is held by Freemason and Conservative MP Jack Lepresti. Out of that 6, 3 got onto the city slackers list, 2 Tories and 1 Labour. The slackers are Dawn Primorolo for Labour, who hasn't been on the show and doesn't want to over the last 3 years, and Chris Skidmore and Charlotte Leslie for the Conservative Party. All three consistently fail to return phone calls or say they're not interested in appearing. I'll be talking about the councillors next week, and that is through the main parties. That was the MPs. Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers, do you think it is acceptable for me to do this, to actually do a list of people who won't return phone calls, won't get back to me when I'm trying to contact them? Do you think that's useful for voters or not?
Absolutely. You're absolutely within your rights to contact them, and if they choose not to reply, you're absolutely within your rights to point that out to people who are listening to this programme. We, you know, what we're about here is holding those in power accountable. Now, if they choose not to be held accountable, the message is clear to the electorate, isn't it?
So the two that haven't, again, is Charlotte Leslie. She came on once just after she'd been elected, but, I mean, consistently will not come on for the last 2 years. And the same with Conservative Chris Skidmore. Also, maybe, as a Labour Party councillor, Jenny, maybe you could explain why Dawn Primorolo might. I mean, I know you can't speak for her, but, I mean, she's in a safe seat. You would have thought that it's actually, maybe she just feels like it's not worth campaigning.
No, I would hope she does feel it's worth coming on a station like this and talking to people, because I assume that most of your listeners are the younger people, and it's the younger people we want to interest in politics and in what goes on in their community. So I would hope that she has very good reasons, but I don't know what they are.
Okay, so that list will be going up this weekend, and in 2 weeks' time we'll be talking about the city councillors on that list of Bristol City slackers. Do look up the past list if you're interested in the meantime. But we'll start by asking Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers this week about this new concept that seems to have been floated this week. It's certainly new to me, maybe not to you, of negative interest rates. This is now being proposed, and now, I mean, for decades, I can remember interest rates going up and down, you know, somewhere between maybe 3% and 15% at the Bank of England. Now they're down to half of 1%, this kind of amount. They're now talking about actually having negative interest rates at the Bank of England. What does that mean?
Well, actually, negative interest rates are a phenomenon that they're quite common, because if you think about it, when inflation is, say, 10% and the interest rate is 5%, then in actual fact, the interest rate isn't 5% at all. And what it is a sign of the desperation of the policymakers to try and do anything to avert the continuance of the depression. And they're hoping to try and keep the stock markets afloat. But I'm afraid I think there's going to be a major worldwide crash We haven't, you know, we've had four years to sort out the problems in the financial system. It hasn't, nothing serious has been done. The stock markets now in the US are just about reaching the peak, that the last two peaks that they reached. It's about to reach a triple peak. I mean, in actual fact, the economy is going down the drain, and at some point the elastic will snap and the banks will collapse.
Well, no, at some point the elastic starts pulling the economy up again. You know, that's what has happened in the past.
That's the theory.
Well, your theory is that it's going to crash for since 2008. That's 5 years now. It hasn't crashed. Well, no, what's happening is that the banks are just extending more and more and more loans and getting more wealth and power.
They're not extending
through
loans.
Through their debts.
They're not. They're using the money from quantitative easing to keep in their banks. They're not doing what the government wants them to do, which is put it into lending things to small industries, to housing, to people who are desperate for it. They are sitting on a nest egg so that their own accounts look good.
That's right. And without all of this support from government, direct and indirect, they'd be bankrupt. And in fact, they are bankrupt. And what should have been happening is they should have been dismantled. But what we've done, in fact, is the governments of the world have propped up the system, which I suppose they had to do because the alternative was chaos. But all that's happened is they've propped up the system, so they've gone back to the casino, carried on gambling. We've got another speculative bubble just as big as the last one, and it will crash. It's 100%. It's a question of when. The stuff I'm reading is suggesting it may be some time in the space between May and September. Sell in May and go away is a famous old saying on the stock exchange.
I know.
I'm afraid that's what it looks like.
Zero Hedge has been saying that a lot of the people in the know in the Wall Street and the City have been taking their money out of stocks and shares quite quietly and buying up commodities of various sorts. So, I mean, things like property, putting it into property, that kind of thing. Jenny?
I'm really worried. I'm worried for the people in the city and for the areas round about this city, because many people live on a bare income, don't have any flexibility in it, don't have any extra money. We've got food banks opening in the city all over. They're going to open one this spring in my ward. And these people are on the real edge. And at the same time, out there are people who are absolutely gambling with our money. Let's be quite honest. If the stock exchange actually had a health warning on it that these were gamblers, then people might be more careful about putting their money there and not putting it into commodities.
Well, what's happening, of course, is that the retail investors in the stock market have come back because of the fact the stock market's been rising for the last two or three years. Mm-hmm. And, of course, once all the fools turn up to buy the stuff, the insiders offload it onto them, and then it crashes, and they're left holding the bill. Yeah. And the big boys have taken all the money and run.
Well,
and that is exactly what's going on.
But talking of the bill, we heard yesterday that RBS has lost more than £5 billion last year. This is the state-owned bank.
And they gave
bank.
Massive bonuses.
And so let's have a listen now to John Snow introducing this, amongst other topics, other banking topics, on last night's Channel 4 News.
Good evening. Half a page of A4. That's all it is. A new European agreement to staunch the hemorrhage of greed and corruption in the banking system, expressed in the cascade of massive bonuses that have characterised banking for the past decade. Bonuses are to be capped at a sum equal to the recipient's annual salary. Only the British government stood out against, and tonight not one single member of the coalition is prepared to defend Britain's loan position. All this as the taxpayer-funded RBS dishes out £600 million in bonuses as the bank posts a loss of £5
billion. £600 million in bonuses, Martin.
Yeah, well, I mean, this is exactly what the problem is. The banking system has been rescued by the taxpayer, and in return, the taxpayer has been given a kick in the teeth. And ultimately, what's happening here is looting. The rigging of the LIBOR rate, I was reading about this earlier on the internet, that's cost to municipalities like Detroit in the US millions, billions, and they are going to sue. And when those legal challenges come to court in the US, British banks are going to be found guilty. And at that point, the British taxpayer will have to pay the bill for what the Americans are going to fine them. And in fact, fining these people doesn't do anything, because they're making more money on the rob than they're going to get paid in fines. The only thing to deter this kind of criminal behaviour is criminal prosecutions and prison sentences. And that's very clear. John Kenneth Galbraith's son, Peter Galbraith, has been campaigning on this. He's an economist in the US. He's been saying the real problem is criminality. And what we've actually got to do is send a lot of these people to prison. And of course they say, well, if you raise taxes on us, we'll run away to the Cayman Islands. The answer to that is, no, you won't. You're going to be in Wormwood Scrubs.
Well, before we hear from Jenny, her reaction, let's hear from a former employee of the Bank of England itself. Mohammed Rafiq was on the staff of the Bank of England in the 1980s and knows how it works from the inside out. Unlike the public faces of the bank now, he's prepared to talk about it in an honest language, which helps rather than hinders the public understanding of how banking works.
The central banking system is a very perverse system, and the BIS, the Bank for International Settlements in Basel, is known as the Central Banker's Central Bank. What it's actually used for is the dissemination of new rules throughout G10 and the European Union for the central banks and their banking systems. It's not where those decisions are made. The decisions are made at places like Davos and Quangos and little secretive clubs and groups here, there and everywhere, where they decide on policy and agendas and how they want the rules to look. Then the BIS has a forum that writes them up as they've been written in the shadow somewhere, and then they're pushed out. So it's more a vehicle for the implementation of legislation but within central banks. But where those rules are made is much murkier and darker. And that's, again, another area, Tony, that's not policed at all and that there's very little oversight of.
What about the EU? Is that going to be a force for good, do you think? Is it likely to come up with any solutions rather than countries like little Iceland coming up with solutions of its own?
I don't think the European Union is brave enough to actually fix its problems, because it would mean challenging current perceived wisdoms. And that's the whole point. You know, to change things needs a new paradigm. And I really don't think that the European Union is brave enough to take that march. I think the UK used to be, I don't know, we're the proud line that we were, we've become a US poodle under Tony Blair, but we were once a proud enough lion to make a stand and do things on our own. I'd like to think we still could somewhere, and if it takes the people to give the politicians a push to remember that they're supposed to be set a moral high bar and a high standard of integrity around the world, rather than washing these crimes under the carpet, because you've got to remember here, Tony, the world watching the way the UK's behaved with this LIBOR scandal, and to be frank, they just see us as a bunch of cheats. That's the way we're perceived in China, it's the way we're perceived in South America, in Russia, in Africa, in lots of the world. They're looking at it and saying, these guys commit crimes and their own countries and governments rubber stamp it, and why should we do business with them? So in the medium to long term, we're damaging the reputation of the City of London as well here.
That was former employee of the Bank of England, Mohammed Rafiq. Now, Jenny, what are your thoughts about the sort of overall... Do you paint as dark a picture as Martin with this idea of a looming crash of some sort?
Yes, I'm extremely worried. I'm worried for the young people in this city, because I think some of them will eventually be pushed so far that they'll start rioting again. And that destroys the rest of their lives, because they get criminal records which they can't break. I worry also for the elderly in our society. We've had a good run, some of us. It's been a lot better than me growing up in a house where inside the windows was frozen water and frost, where we only had one fire for the whole of the house. All the things I remember, the fact that people were unemployed and there was no real benefit. I remember someone coming to our house when I was young, when my father had cancer of the throat, and they said, oh, you've got things here you could sell. And I remember taking the carving knife and putting it into the sink, because my mother was sobbing her heart out on the kitchen table. We are going back to those days. And what are we handing our children? And as far as I'm concerned, this has been done by some of the well-off, the top people in our country. And they have besmirched our good name and are actually destroying what was something we were very proud about, the fact that this country was known for honesty and straight dealing in the past. And the majority of people are still like that.
Well, it'd be nice to think that what with the election of a new mayor back last year, that things have changed. But it is worrying to see that that George Ferguson is using this employee from KPMG, Matt Payne, as one of his advisors, going through the budget, for example, over the last few months, looking at various, looking at actually what KPMG are. They are undergoing a two-year-long special investigation by the Competition Commission into fraud and price fixing. Jenny, do you think it's appropriate to have somebody from such an organisation in there, sort of handpicked by the mayor to be helping him go through the budget?
I would sincerely hope that he thinks twice, but I know that there's a Liberal Democrat councillor that also works for them.
Who's that?
I've forgotten his name. Okay. I know his ward.
What's his ward?
It's either Cabot or Cabot, I think.
Okay. With KPMG, Martin, last week there was a report on Friday by the Competition Commission, an interim report from this investigation into these auditing firms. I know they're not your favourite customers, are they? Because you think that they're responsible, for example, for, and you're quite right, signing off the accounts of the banks in the run-up to the 2008 crash, saying that everything was fine. And then, of course, in 2008, we found much of the information on these banks' accounts was just junk. It wasn't actually worth anything. They said, for example, last week that one of the things that these auditors have been doing was collaborating with the banks so that when the banks were issuing a loan to an organisation, it actually had a clause in there to say that the organisation, whoever it is, a business, had to use one of these big four auditing firms. So, I mean, what are we doing in this kind of... that does sound like that's a totally unreasonable clause to have in a contract, a loan contract from a bank, that you have to use the same auditors as they do, especially when it looks like there's price fixing going on.
It's not just price fixing. Don't forget the fundamental flaw is that those who are paying for the auditing get the auditors that they want. Auditors are not independent. This is what came absolutely clear with Arthur Andersen and Enron. Enron employed Arthur Andersen basically to help them cook the books. And what you've got now is several sets of books in every big organisation. There's the official set for tax purposes, then there's a second set and a third set and a fourth set, and you've got all sorts of what they call structured investment vehicles, which are not on the actual books. And of course, the auditors, far from putting the stop to this, they collaborate in arranging it all so that their customers, that is to say the big banks and multinationals, get what they want. And the system as a whole, frankly, has become a cesspit. And the problem is that once one lot of people starts doing that, those who try and do it do it the proper way and not try and cheat, they get pushed out of business. And so ultimately the whole system, one bad apple, does spoil the whole barrel. Okay. Because gradually it spreads.
They kind of dumb down, don't they? Because the one who's cheating makes the most profit. So everyone looks at them and thinks, well,
and
maybe
if they get away with it, then everybody else has got to do the same.
What about a race
to the bottom?
What about what Mohammed Rafiq was saying just now about the banking rules being written in the shadows? Surely there's no way that something so important should be written in the shadows. He's talking about amongst private groups, and then they're formalised at Basel in Switzerland at the Bank for International Settlements. Surely, to goodness, this is something that someone like Osborne, that our elected representatives need to be involved in actually drawing up these banking rules. They shouldn't be being written in the shadows.
Well, that's quite right. And if you look at the way the LIBOR scandal is panning out, it's based in the City of London. The British banks were at the heart of it, although various multinational... What's a British bank these days? They're all multinational. They're all got cross linkages, and they all owe each other money. So the system's a seamless web. And basically, they were rigging it so that they could make money. So that leads to a situation where the state of California lost billions of dollars, which could have been spent on schools, hospitals, roads, whatever. And where did that money go? It went into the pockets of the bankers. Money that should have been spent on welfare for the people of California.
Well, it's
and
a bit,
they are suing. They are suing for the money.
It's a bit cheeky when they say that, oh, we must pay the bankers more, otherwise they might go away. Maybe they should go away. Maybe that would be a good thing.
Can I come in for a second? I actually, when I worked for Shelter, found a landlord that had two sets of books. And I had one of the tenants tell me where the other set was. So Customs and Excise found out.
And it's all about proper investigation. And playing the, as Mohammed Rafiq pointed out there, if you don't clean your house out, nobody will do business with you. So what they're doing is actually sawing off the branch they're sitting on. The great comparative advantage Britain has in financial services, and it's one of our biggest industries and all the rest of it. If you carry on cheating, nobody will do business with you, and the whole thing just crashes and burns, and that, I'm afraid, is what's going to happen.
Okay, from the, shall we say, the global picture, and the European picture certainly, to the local one. Now, Bristol Council has approved Mayor George Ferguson's first budget, which includes £35 million worth of cuts, Jenny, on Tuesday. Can you just tell us, you know, what happened?
I felt very uneasy about it, and I know other members of the Labour group did. We abstained because we had... during the session leading up to the budget going into the meeting, we had been able to encourage all sorts of items back in and save them, and at the very last minute there was only one item we hadn't successfully got into the budget, but we did during the debate, during the meeting, and then we abstained because it would look like we were actually voting against our own amendments. But there was a feeling in the group that we really didn't want to vote for a £34 million cut. It's going to affect not only 320 jobs of employees in the City Council, it will also affect all the businesses that we use to repair the tower blocks and all sort of other provisions that are throughout the city. The impact of that will be felt slowly and steadily throughout the city, and next year they're talking about another £58 million coming forward to us. This is destroying what is the heartblood of the city, and we are being told that the only services that are probably possibly be protected are going to be home care and the care for the elderly and children. That means our libraries are all being considered for changing the ethos, perhaps handing over to communities like has happened in other parts of the country, and many of our other services we will either receive only if we pay for them. What can I say?
Well, I mean, one thing you can say is, once the most vulnerable in the city are, of course, people who are homeless, and there were proposals to actually cut a massive amount from £280,000 from council homelessness services.
Yes, I know that. They kept arguing with me that actually there was £1 million set aside for emergency for homeless, and I was pointing out that. Actually, the homeless among us now. I'm seeing them. I was down in Berkeley Square at a meeting on women's health, and I came out and there was someone in the porch of the church there, asleep in a sleeping bag. At St. George, they're in church doorways now, they're in the cemeteries, they're hiding. I wondered whether we're going back to when in the 1970s I actually worked in Bristol. With homeless people, and they were in the cupboards in the BRI because it was the only place they could keep warm.
Well,
we are walking backwards in time instead of proudly going on and making it a safe city for everybody in it.
I think it was Cambridge, wasn't it, where they said, Martin, that someone would have been sleeping for months in the library. They'd been sneaking in just before the library closed, hiding under a table, and then basically using the warm library as a safe place to sleep overnight.
I've been telling people in my ward who can't cope with their electricity and fuel bills, go into the library and sit down and read because it's warm in there. There won't be libraries soon the way this is going on.
The other thing is, a place where I camped as a teenager down in Wells, just south of the cathedral, is some woods down there, which just for a couple of days. I happened to walk through it yesterday, and actually, I mean, I don't know, it's difficult to say how many, scores of tents, people just living in tents in the
benders
woods.
Are back. Benders, people sleeping in backs of cars. We're going back to what was called the New Age Travellers, which I've got research that hasn't been published, and if someone would like to sit down with me and we'll publish it, showed that they were really the homeless, that was the only way they could keep their bits together was have either an old truck, a bus, a car, somewhere to put it in, so that every time they were evicted off of land, they at least took their bare possessions with them.
I suppose a halfway house between that and actually paying rent that you can't afford is the boaters. A lot of people live on the canals, don't they, in Britain still?
Well, that's right.
Anyway, Martin, what's the solution here? Because this is a problem we need to nip in the bud, really, before it starts getting any worse.
Well, the main point I would make is cutting public expenditure at this moment is simply stupid. We've just lost our credit rating. Wasn't it George Osborne saying the first thing we must do, the thing that the whole policy is around this, we mustn't lose our credit rating. That's why we're cutting 35 million from the budget, etc. And we've started to lose our credit rating this week. I think it was Moody's, wasn't it? We've been downgraded. And of course they just shrugged it off and said, oh well, because we've lost our credit rating, that means we've got to carry on cutting public expenditure. Now actually, there is no case whatsoever for cutting public expenditure in this situation. Just keeping the level of public expenditure up won't save us from a banking collapse, I'm afraid, but cutting public expenditure will make it certain. The austerity policies that are being pursued all over the world are actually making the debt situation worse, and that is why it's 100% that there's going to be a crash.
I mean, does it make sense before the crash for the government to actually seize control of the creation of money and the banking system into the Treasury's hands, either the Treasury or Europe-wide or possibly even worldwide? Somehow something needs to be done so that the private bankers have the system of creating money and lending money out of their hands.
I totally agree with you, but it won't happen because we haven't got the political movements necessary to discipline the ruling class. People basically have been depoliticized for years, and they basically take what they're given, and they're not strong enough to resist either intellectually or physically. And I'm afraid we'll have to go through the crash, and then the penny will drop. And at that point, things will have to be reconstructed, and it won't be reconstructed on the previous basis. That's the only hope I can offer. But because, I mean, what should have been happening is that the governments of the world should have been, you know, beating these people up with baseball bats and extracting the money back.
Well,
that hasn't been happening.
You mean George Osborne should have been doing it?
No, I don't mean that literally, but the point is, once the banking system got to the situation where it needed to be bailed out, that was the point at which the democratic system should have overruled them. But in fact, the democratic system is too weak, and that's largely because, in the US, for example, it's Wall Street that pays for the politicians. That's what gets them elected, and they can't go against them. And that is a real problem.
Okay.
Can I say one of my concerns is that UWE are now cutting their courses in politics, and yet on those courses people are actually encouraged to think about all the differences between political thinking in this country. And I've never been afraid of saying that I'm a socialist. It means that I care about the community I live in, I can see a different way of living in it, and encouraging people to have pride in themselves, which is not part of some of the other political groups' thinking. And what can I say? What we really want is to set up classes of politics so that the young can choose which ones they think are the clearest to fit their way of life and the way of life that will help everyone else as well.
Okay, well, off to Westminster now. Wednesday, Prime Minister's Questions was back, and a bit of a mess from Ed Miliband as he sort of shot himself in the foot to a certain extent, replying to a question from David Cameron, or not a question from David Cameron, but David Cameron pointing out, quoting from the New Statesman and using it actually against Ed Miliband. So let's have a listen to that exchange now.
Let's examine the fact that the New Statesman, the in-house magazine of the Labour Party, says this. His critique of the government strategy will never win back public trust. His proposals for the economy will never convince. His credibility problem will only become magnified as the general election approaches. That's not Conservative Central Office, that's the New Statesman.
Greatest of respect to the New Statesman, he's scraping the barrel, really, by quoting the New Statesman.
Scraping the barrel, says Ed Miliband, by quoting the New Statesman, and that's one of the only papers that actually supports him, Martin.
Yes, but the guy who's writing it is Anthony Selsden, who is actually the headmaster of Wellington College and is a Tory. And of course, he's sniping and undermining Ed Miliband. And that is his job, and that's exactly what he's done, giving the Prime Minister a nice, easy, underarm ball to bowl. Who is Anthony Selsden? Oh, he's a Tory public school headmaster. That's all we need to know, isn't it?
But, I mean, why is he saying you're scraping the barrel by quoting the New Statesman?
Well, because what he's trying to do... I mean, Miliband is basically being stabbed in the back there by the New Statesman. That's
well,
what's
happened.
He's
stabbing himself in the back, Jenny, anyway. I mean, it didn't really go down very well.
I don't read the New Statesman.
What do you read?
Tribune.
You don't? Oh, okay.
The Guardian. Anything, really, that's going. I'm a readaholic. I would even read the Times to see what the other side had said. But I don't read the New Statesman. I had The Economist for about 8 months and then decided, one, I couldn't afford to go on reading it, but also there was so much to take in. But I was listening to the opposition and I knew it. And that's important. You listen to both sides in the debate before you decide where you personally believe you stand.
OK, well, we've got two Labour Party members in the studio here, so I'm going to go back 20 years and give you another little clip from Prime Minister's Questions, this time with John Smith talking about privatisation with John Major. See if you can compare Ed Miliband's performance with John Smith's 20 years ago.
Well, the people of Britain don't want the low-skilled sweatshop economy, yeah! Which is the miserable Tory response to the challenge of competition from Europe and the wider world. What they do want is for us to become a high-skilled, high-tech, high-wage economy, able to compete with the best and succeed on the basis of our ability and the quality of our products in the markets of the world. If we were to offer this tale of events to the BBC Light Entertainment Department as a script for a programme, I think the producers of Yes Minister would have turned it down as hopelessly over the top. I think it might have even been too much for some mothers do have them.
So there's a little bit more witty repartee. I mean, if nothing else, Martin, surely that's what Prime Minister's Questions is about. It's about actually a bit of wit from both sides and someone getting the better of the other.
Yes, wit rather than clumsy character assassination. I mean, what people are sick of is listening to that kind of debate conducted in that kind of spirit. How can I put it? The banks are about to collapse. There's possibly going to be a world war starting in the Middle East. Now, our serious politicians at the top level should sound serious, and that's one of the problems. They don't sound serious. It's all knockabout stuff, isn't it?
Jenny, what do you think
of... It sounds like young public school boys just having a bit of fun. A rag still. It's about time they grew up.
An interesting little story, though, in this week's Post. Jeremy Clarkson is the favourite to succeed George Ferguson as Bristol Mayor. Well, I suppose I'll ask you both. Do you think that's a real content that Clarkson is... I mean, this seems to me like the Evening Post just sort of implanting one of their favourites into the public's mind as a possible successor to Ferguson. But, I mean, who's your favourite to succeed Ferguson as Bristol Mayor, Jenny?
Well, obviously, I supported the Labour candidate. I thought he was sound, he was on the edges of politics, and he seemed to care about human beings and what was happening. So, as far as I'm concerned, we had the best candidate during that election.
Martin.
Well, I totally agree with that, and no doubt we will...
You're both loyal party people.
Well, no, it wasn't just that. I think Marvin was an excellent candidate by any definition. An excellent candidate, and we were very disappointed to lose. But... we will fight everything, as we always do. Tackle, tackle, tackle. That's what you've got to do. Get the ball into their half and then score some goals.
OK, another story related to privatisation this time. Bristol Swimming Club fears for future after teaching ban. Bristol Swimming Club fears for its future due to a ban on teaching youngsters in council-run pools. Portway Swimming Club, which has taught an estimated 3,000 youngsters how to swim during the last 70 years, uses council-owned Henbury Pool for its twice-weekly sessions. But from the 1st of April, the club will no longer be able to use the pool to teach the newest recruits. Usually the youngest, aged 5 and 6 upwards, because of a new contract between the council and a firm called Sports and Leisure Management, SLM, which runs most of the council's leisure centres. The contract means only SLM will be able to provide lessons in council-run pools to swimmers who are taking the first 7 levels of the Learn to Swim's national teaching plan. Jenny, this is a bit awful,
well,
isn't it? This
club, that worrying.
This club has been there for 70 years. It's now being told, sorry, you've got to go. And only certain types of courses will be able to be taught, not these ones for the youngsters?
Well, I learnt to swim in a pool and was trained by someone that put limpet mines on submarines during the war.
Buster Crabbe or something
yes,
like that.
Yes, no, he was terrific. And he taught me underwater swimming, and I was breaststroke champion for the Newbury area. And it did my health the world of good. And that's what we've got to think about. There isn't one set way of teaching people. I taught all my children to swim. But at the same time, we must think about the health of future generations. And if this means that they can only get swimming lessons if they pay for them and are restricted from getting them from a wide variety of people, because everybody that teaches swimming teaches slightly differently.
But Martin, the main point here being that Portway Swimming Club has been shut out. There's some other people coming in and they've been told, no, go away.
Well, that's because they've privatised the whole setup, haven't they? These things used to be run by the council for public benefit. Now, we've got a private company called Sports and Leisure Management. And do you know what they're there for? I've got a secret to tell you. They're there to make money. That's what they're there for. And that's the problem, isn't it? It's just, there it is, in a nutshell, what's gone wrong with this country over the last 30 years.
So the less well-off children won't get swimming lessons.
That's right.
Whereas they probably need it more than some of the better-off.
And just the other point I'd make is look at something like this, which has been going for 70 years and is dug into the community and everybody knows it and everybody knows how it works. The conservative philosophy ought to be to conserve things, surely. But no, we're going to throw this out of the window, we're going to do it completely differently, and it's cash, cash, cash all the way, otherwise we can't afford to do
but
it.
But I mean, what's,
we've got to cut back and all the rest
well,
of it.
Well, what they've done, of course, is they've probably saved money here, and this contract is going to cost them less than it would have cost otherwise.
Well, indeed, but the whole point is that they shouldn't be cutting public expenditure at all, as I pointed out previously. We should be spending more on things like this. More of the, if we employed local people to teach people to swim, they'd go and spend the money in local shops, wouldn't they? Oh yes, that would be right. Yes, well, wouldn't it? It would, wouldn't it? The whole philosophy of cutting public expenditure is misguided.
Tory MP Jack Lopresti has been forced to put his feet up after a lengthy illness takes its toll. This is our Freemason MP, which I kind of remind people about his Masonic membership as much as possible because nobody else seems to talk about it much. That's Jack Lopresti, the MP for Filton and Bradley Stoke, has praised staff at French A Hospital. But what the Evening Post or the Post haven't reported is in Private Eye this week, and if you haven't seen it, I suggest you get a copy, which is Jack Lopresti's recent jolly to £6,600 jolly to Saudi Arabia. Quite what he's been doing. I mean, obviously he's very connected with the people at BAE Systems, arms manufacturers. And Martin, what tell us a little bit about Saudi Arabia. And what, I mean, Jack was there between 1st and the 4th of December 2012, and Private Eye have written about it, and it's also on They Work For You website, the information that Jack has been over in Saudi Arabia doing what looks like, potentially anyway, arms dealing.
All right, well, first thing I'd say, if Jack is ill, I'm sorry to hear that. And if he's in hospital, anybody who's listening, Jack is not one of your city slackers. He has been on the show, has he not?
Yes, yeah.
And, you know, we didn't agree, but then we're not
going
to.
But I haven't seen this. This hasn't been in the local paper at all.
No, I know. I just wanted to make that clear. I mean, when your political opponents are not well, you wish them well. We're not here to be nasty to people. We're here to solve the problems. And, as you say...
I think what I'm trying to do here is make the point.
Let's come to Saudi Arabia.
Yeah.
Okay? The Tory party has got a disgustingly close relationship with the Saudi regime. It goes back a long way. If you remember the Al-Yamamah defence deal, the biggest defence deal in history, Saudi Arabia is a totally corrupt country run by a ruling family put in power by the British in the 1920s. And there's an awful lot of money to be made by selling them weaponry. And there's massive kickbacks that go to the Saudis and to people at the top here. And BAE Systems and Saudi Arabia, probably the biggest criminal enterprise between them in the world. And of course, this is the way the world works. The Saudi regime went with Colonel Gaddafi. Hillary Clinton and no doubt the Tories here were cheering when he was shot in the head and sodomised with a bayonet by the rebels. What do you think should happen to King Fahd of Saudi Arabia? Because of course we want bloody revolution in the Arab world, don't we? Bloody revolution, and bloody revolution for Saudi Arabia as well. Put them all up against the wall. What do we think?
Jenny, this trip to Saudi Arabia, Jack's got £6,600 basically paid for by the Saudi government, at the same time as there's all sorts of talk of arms deals, as he is also quite close to BAE Systems, the arms manufacturer, who are the owners of Filton Airfield in his constituency.
Well, similarly, I'm sorry to hear that he's ill, but at the same time, as with my religion, I'm against violence and anything that causes the world to end up in major wars. And I feel that a lot of the, well, in fact, I know that a lot of the arms that are going into Saudi Arabia are leaking out in all directions into other parts of the Gulf states.
Well, they're openly supporting, for example, the rebels in Syria, supplying them with weapons.
And the old Aden part of the Arab states are getting a lot of these weapons, which worries me. All I can say is that this goes back a long way, and it is about time we also spoke to some of these countries and suggested that they got some moral principles as well about what they're doing, because I don't think they realise the knock-on effect it has, not only on the this part of the world, but also on us and everybody else in the world. A lot of these arms end up in the hands of people who have no... They never think twice about using them on anybody and judge other people instantly on what nationality they are, not what sort of human being they are, and so they like killing.
Another story this week. Yesterday, in fact, the Pope stepped aside. Vatican, this is in the Daily Mail, Vatican backlash over dossier rumours linking the church to a gay network and sex parties. Vatican has rubbished Italian media reports alleging the Pope's resignation is linked to a secret dossier claiming there's a gay network inside the clergy. Italian newspapers have been rife with reports claiming the secret dossier from three cardinals reveals an underground network of senior clergy who have organised gay homosexual parties and faced blackmail. La Repubblica newspaper claims the explosive allegations were made in a report into the so-called VatiLeaks scandal, which was presented to the pontiff on or around the 17th of December. But the Vatican today accused Italian media of spreading false and damaging reports. Difficult to know, but this is certainly, I mean, this is what the Italian media are saying, and we're not really hearing a lot about it here, Martin.
No, I mean, frankly, if adult clergy in the Catholic Church are having sex with each other of same sex, I'm not bothered. I don't care. I really don't. But if they are abusing their positions of authority, that's another issue again.
Well, the issue with this report is that it leaves them open to blackmail, prone to blackmail.
Well, but blackmail for... I mean, they wouldn't be open to blackmail if they were just open about it. I mean, the problem, there's been problems with sex and the Catholic Church, as we all know, and everybody's very aware about, including the Pope. I think there's another possible layer to this, which is a lot of the dirty money that flows through the Vatican Bank, which is linked to crime and the intelligence services and so on. That possibly may be behind it, or it may just be that the Pope's resigning because he's old. He is old.
It's the first time for hundreds of years, though, Jenny. Any thoughts on the Pope's resignation?
Yes, I think the whole of the Catholic Church have got to think seriously about this. I think they've got to allow the priest to marry, like we have vicars that get married, that they have families and children, so they understand then more about the lives of their parishioners, because it's a teaching ground, bringing up children. And if they really... it's almost a denial of part of love, which is in our society. And it can be love for a man to a woman, or men to men, or women to women. And I think the Catholic Church has got to go back and think very, very hard about whether they allow a more normal background for their priests to live in.
Okay, our final story tonight. Too much power in too few hands. Quite a nice little piece in The Independent. This is about food giants taking over the industry. The livelihoods of millions of smallholders who produce the drinks and snacks that we consume every day are seriously under threat, warns a report to be published this week, and marking the start of Fair Trade Fortnight. Extreme price volatility, high food prices and more concentrated food markets threaten to leave farmers condemned to poverty. Three companies now account for more than 40% of global coffee sales. Eight companies control the supply of cocoa and chocolate. Seven control 85% of all tea production. Five, 75% of the world's banana trade. The largest six sugar traders account for two-thirds of world trade, according to the new publication from the Fair Trade Foundation. Jenny, certainly this is Cargill's is doing grain, many other of these companies. There was a big merger last year between grain companies. It seems that control of our food is going into fewer hands, in the background, as well as, of course, in our supermarkets.
It's used on the stock market in order to control as much of the certain markets as possible, to put the price up, to make a fortune for a small majority of people. Can I say that I think fair trade should work, and fair trade has worked, but what we ought to be looking now at the multinationals who are actually making money out of other people's food.
Martin, this is in the background as well as the supermarkets.
Yes, and I'm afraid that it's not just accidental either. Controlling food markets is the goal, and so that basically countries can be bullied. We'll cut off your food supply if you don't do as we say.
OK, we're coming up now to the Murdoch News at 6. Thanks very much to this week's guest, Labour Councillor for Southmead, Jenny Smith. After the news, the BBC and documentary producer Mike Rudin specifically in court this week.
BCFM is an award-winning community radio station for Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour. Live from the sky.
From the Sky News Centre at 6, a court has been played the emergency 999 call.